Retro Society welcomes you to our Deco Retro program here on Planet FM. We will bring you interesting interviews, updates of future Deco Society and other related events, also book reviews, handy household hints, and other snippets capturing the glamour and fascination of a bygone era. Deco Retro. Deco Retro.
Good afternoon, listeners. You're with Philippa, and joining us on the program today is Guy Clapshaw, the author of Tasman Echo Alpha. This novel gives a fascinating insight into the politics and culture of New Zealand's airline industry in the 1960s, an exciting time to be a young pilot during the early days of our national airline. Although Tasman Echo Alpha is a novel, many of the extraordinary and hilarious tales and anecdotes are based on Guy's own experiences and observations. Keen to further his career, 26-year-old Guy left Britain and moved to Auckland in 1965 to take up employment as a Lockheed Electra co-pilot and navigator with New Zealand's tiny regional airline, Tasman Empire Airways, or TEAL as it was known. In order to expand its route network, TEAL had acquired Lockheed Electra and DC-8 aircraft and now needed pilots to fly those exciting new routes. The pilots, engineers, and navigators who flew for TEAL in those days were a colourful group of interesting individuals with nicknames such as Gigantor, Scratchy, 006.5, who all had a passion for flying and a sense of adventure. Excellent flying skills, ingenuity, quick thinking, and a cool head were essential when flying through tropical storms, electrical failure, or some other in-flight emergency without all the technology and safeguards we have today. When relaxing under the tropical sun and swaying palm trees on terra firma, life was at times alcohol-fueled, but always with good humour, comradeship, and gusto. However, when airborne, they were all loyal and dedicated professionals. That was the unspoken golden rule. They were flying for the airline that would later be recognized around the world as the symbol of a small but proud nation, Air New Zealand. Welcome to the program, Guy.
Thank you, Philippa.
Now, on arriving in Auckland, you were immediately sent on a training course in preparation for flying the Electras to the Pacific Islands and Australia. What were the Electras like to fly without being too technical?
It was a very exhilarating aircraft because this is only 20 years after the end of World War II.
Yes.
And they had four 4,000 horsepower engines, and so they were actually faster than the World War II Spitfires and Typhoons and Messerschmitts and things like that. So it was like being given a high-performance sports car to go to work in. Very exhilarating.
That must have been exciting.
Very exciting, yeah.
Now, you mentioned living in Mendelssohn Mansions in Herne Bay, where life was never dull. The building might have been drab, but the residents certainly weren't. It sounded a bit of a madhouse. Tell us about it.
It was, yes. It had a variety of people, mainly air crew, some from National Airways and others from Air New Zealand, but also some other people, just shop owners and things like that. And, yeah, every day, if you weren't flying, it was the start of an adventure. You'd go sailing or shopping or something like that.
And I believe there were two gay guys,
yes,
who lived on the top floor.
That's right. Yes, they kept an art gallery.
Yes.
And they had a little monkey they called Baby, who they they used to take for walks in a perambulator. And one day in the story, he unfortunately his perambulator got confused with another one with a human baby.
Oh,
and
no.
You can imagine the results. Yes.
Oh no. Yes, and I believe the parrot used to, on occasion, come out with expletives.
Not occasionally, always.
Always. Yeah.
Yes.
Now, one of the stories was the Royal Duchess on a Wellington to Sydney flight, who dropped a gold and diamond bangle down the first-class dunny and inquired if it could possibly be retrieved. Understandably, the response was less than enthusiastic. But it did have a funny ending.
It did, yes. The Australian ground engineers weren't interested in retrieving it, but our young flight engineer, who was very ingenious, he went through the leavings, if you like, and he recovered it, and then he gave it to our agent, who washed it and returned it to Her Royal Highness. And we had 2 days in Sydney, and when we were checking out of the hotel, there was a little package for the flight engineer, and it was wrapped in beautiful wrapping paper, and when he unwrapped it, there was a note from her, the Duchess's principal social secretary, saying, I'm asked to convey the thanks of Her Royal Highness, and would you please accept this as a token of her appreciation? And there was this beautifully red leather box with the royal seal on the lid and the name of a very expensive London department store. And when he opened it, there was some wrapping paper, and when he removed the wrapping paper, he found a bar of very expensive toilet soap.
what a letdown.
Yeah, it was very appropriate, of course, yes.
Yeah, appropriate, but yeah. I think you'd expect a gold watch or something, wouldn't
at
you?
Least, yes, at least, yes. At least. And probably a knighthood as well.
Now, flying between Samoa and the Cook Islands took 5.5 hours over endless ocean. And if flying through a tropical storm, there could be problems. Could you explain the critical point in relation to this and
yes,
some of the problems?
The critical point was approximately the halfway point, where if you thought the weather the other end was too bad, you turned round and went back. Or if you had an in-flight emergency like a heart attack, you needed to get to a doctor as quickly as possible. The more important thing was the point of no return, where that's the point beyond the halfway stage where you can still turn around and go back to your destination if you have to.
Yes.
Which sometimes you had to because of weather.
Sobering thought.
Yes, yes.
I know Jean Batten, that was the thing she found the hardest and loneliest. Yeah.
Yes, and she was on her own, of course. She didn't have a navigator.
Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah. Now, on the subject of flying over endless ocean, there's one story I found quite terrifying. And that was the transcontinental plane that overshot Fiji and went missing. This is a really interesting one. Tell us what actually happened.
Well, what happened was it was what the Americans called a non-sked airline. These were little charter outfits who bought the things like DC-8s and 707s off the scheduled airlines, and then they operated them on charter flights and things like that. The maintenance wasn't the best. The crews worked very hard, and on this occasion, they'd flown from San Francisco to Honolulu with only two pilots and no navigator, and so tired that they fell asleep before they got to Nandi and overflew Nandi. And it was only when the stewardess went up into the cockpit and said, "Hey, fellas, I thought we'd be there by now," that they woke up and realized they'd overflown it.
Oh.
And I was on the ground. I was a co-pilot on the DC-8, and our captain was called to the control tower, and he knew that if they stayed up where they were in the jet stream, that yes. would blow them back to Fiji.
Oh.
And that's just what it did. But it was such a tight thing that it ran out of fuel shortly after landing. So that's about as
My
tight as you
goodness,
want to get.
That was yes. lucky, wasn't it?
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yes.
Now, on another interesting thing is apparently there were some cultural difficulties when asking for help from Indonesian and also Philippine air traffic controllers in those days when there wasn't our technology.
Yes, in those days we operated a high-frequency radio which was prone to interference from thunderstorms and things like that, and often over that airspace, you'd lose contact with the controllers and you'd have to speak to other aircraft, find which airway they were on and which direction they were going.
Right. So anyway, I think now we'll just take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue.
If you wish to learn more about the Auckland Art Deco Society, email Sue Olsen, S-U-E-O-L-S-E-N, at extra.co.nz. If you wish to join the Auckland Art Deco Society, phone Sue Olsen, 832-9493.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Guy Clapshaw about his novel Tasman Echo Alpha. One of the funniest stories is when you describe an emergency procedures course aboard a life raft on the Manukau Harbour with an instructor who was like Mr. Bean, and everything that could go wrong did go wrong.
Yes, I think that's about it. That story is heavily embellished.
Yes.
For instance, his name wasn't Richard Wacker. I emphasize this is a novel. It's not a history. And in the story, they did get washed out through the Manukau heads because they hadn't put out the sea anchor and things like that. And then they got washed in again. And so it ended happily, but it could have been far more serious.
It could have, yes.
And I threw in other things, like when he was demonstrating the handcuffs, he lost the key and things
right.
like that.
and the emergency phone.
Yes.
Something happened with that. He dropped that or something.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to put it across, but I actually found that one of the most funniest stories.
Yes. It's probably 5% true.
It sort of started funny, then got a bit serious.
And then
a sigh of relief.
Yes.
Now, I love the story about the Samoan chief who would cycle across the runway every Sunday afternoon, or morning, I should say, after church, regardless of whether a plane was coming into land. In the rule book, it said planes had to give way to cyclists.
Yes, rather unique, isn't it?
It is.
The Samoan rules of the air. What happened was, on Sunday mornings, we'd have a shuttle service connecting with the Air New Zealand DC-8, and one of them landed at Faleolo 5 minutes after the end of morning church service, and this dear old Samoan chief, whose tribe owned the land, would cycle across the airstrip, and often we were a quarter of a mile from touchdown. And we couldn't do anything about it because it was his land and he could do as he likes. So a very good friend of mine, he cured the problem. One day he timed his arrival so that just as he was on short finals, the chief was cycling across the runway. Instead of landing, he went to full power and put the propellers into fine pitch and scared the living daylights out of the chief, and the problem went away after that. I thought it was very good thinking.
It was, yes. Oh, dear. Now, another one was the weighty problem story when the plane only just managed to take off on the shuttle flight between Faleolo and Panganga.
Yes. Again, that was one of these shuttle flights, and our agent in Pango Pango decided to put two loads of passengers on the aircraft so as to save the cost of another flight. Unfortunately, he didn't tell me, and it wasn't until we got airborne that I realized the aircraft wasn't performing, and I couldn't think why. All I noticed was the windows were fogging up, and that was because of the 60 people. All breathing, and
yes.
it wasn't until the hostess came up and said, do you mind if I stay in the cockpit for landing? I said, no, your place is in the passenger cabin. And she said, there's no room. And I looked round, because she'd left the door open, and it was like the London Underground at rush hour, the people standing in the aisles.
So they stood the whole flight?
Yeah, yes.
Extraordinary.
I think we had 59 people on board a 30-seat aircraft, so that's why it wasn't performing.
My goodness. It's a wonder you got up in the air.
Yes.
At all.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Now, you spent a wonderful 2 years based in California, in Los Angeles, in California, where despite the non-fraternization rule, you had a clandestine romance with one of the air hostesses, Colleen, who became your wife. But before I ask you about that ridiculous non-fraternization rule. If you could just tell us about 006½.
Yes, this is my favourite story. And incidentally, it didn't happen in Air New Zealand, but it was so good that I put it in the book. This was a very senior captain in a foreign airline who retired and didn't tell his wife he'd retired. He was a bit of a stag, so three or four times a month he'd change into his uniform, his wife would drive him to the airport, he'd kiss her goodbye, and then his girlfriend would pick him up and they'd go away to a Rewa or somewhere like that for 3 days of horizontal folk dancing. Unfortunately, one day his wife phoned up because she'd heard the Singapore flight, which he supposedly was on, was delayed. And she said, this is Captain X's wife, what time is my husband's flight due? And unfortunately for him, she was speaking to a new flight dispatcher who said, oh, no, he retired 3 years ago. And anyway, she put two and two together, and he was found out. And I think that was probably the most spectacular moment of my flying career, when she confronted him. I thought I was going to witness a murder.
Oh, my goodness. Well, he wouldn't be the first man who's done something like that.
No.
Oh, goodness. So now, is that connected with the non-fraternization?
Funnily enough, he came out of retirement and then became a chief pilot in Los Angeles, and his wife made this rule that single air crew weren't allowed to fraternize or socialize with the young air hostesses, which was a ridiculous thing to do because it was like putting them in gilded cages. They became irresistible, and I began going out with one, and eventually, of course, the romance blossomed and we married, but it was very disgraceful. It was like a monk marrying a nun, you know. Co-pilots and hostesses, they didn't get married in Los Angeles.
That's rather exciting.
Imagine that today.
Yeah, that's right. Guy, the Auckland International Airport opened in 1966, so your timing was really good when you came to New Zealand. Can you tell us something about teal? And those, how the airline industry grew over the time you were with it, or you've been with it for a very long time.
Well, that was probably my main motivation for writing the book, because I was privileged to join this little tiny airline with three propeller aircraft just flying regionally, and they had the impertinence to buy the very latest jet aircraft and think they could compete internationally to America, Hong Kong, Singapore, and eventually London, of course, against the big boys like Pan American, UTA, Qantas, BOAC. And everybody said they won't last 5 minutes. But the proof of the pudding is that we're now a major international airline with 106 aircraft. So Tasman Echo Alpha only records the first 5 years when we made a lot of mistakes, but we learnt from our mistakes, and we eventually became the airline that we are today.
Yes, it's amazing, really, because Air New Zealand has a very good reputation worldwide.
Oh, yes,
as I said earlier. But writing the book, tell us more about the actual writing of your book.
The reason for that was, as a teenager, I'd always enjoyed books like Doctor in the House and Brothers in Law and those wonderful vet books, All Things Bright and Beautiful.
Oh, they were wonderful stories.
Weren't they? Yes. And initially, of course, I wish I'd been a doctor or a vet or a lawyer and could have written something like that. But when I joined the Air Force and got into the flying business, I realized there were just as many characters there. We had a hypochondriac meteorologist who used to go around saying the weather didn't agree with him, which is not a very appropriate thing for a meteorologist to say. In the airline industry, you had all kinds of oddball characters you flew with, some with very distinguished war records. They'd been pathfinders and things like that in Bomber Command. And so I began to put all these together into my first book, which came out in 1995, and I think the formula worked. So there's now a book about doctors, lawyers, vets, and now there's
one about
aviation.
You.
Well, not me, but the aviation.
I mean, the aviation
industry.
Which is quite fascinating. Quite fascinating.
And it's almost like an endless source of good stories.
Yes.
And sometimes when I run out of inspiration, we have lots of lunches and things like that about four times a year. I'll go along to one of those, buy a few drinks and listen, and there's another chapter of the next book.
Oh, how exciting. Well, New Zealand must have been a little bit of a culture shock coming from Britain in the 1960s.
It was rather, Philippa, yes, because you had 6 o'clock closing. All the pubs closed at 6 o'clock and everybody went home for tea. You had import licensing. You couldn't buy new cars here.
Oh, that's right.
Unless you had overseas funds. And if you had overseas funds, of course, the car dealers treated you like royalty. So all of a sudden, this little airline, Teal, broke the mold, if you like, and began flying to the Orient and the USA. And I remember somebody wrote to the New Zealand Herald, and because we had two DC-8 services a week, and the DC-8 carried 130 passengers, and this reader wrote in and said, 260 people coming into the country a week, where are we going to accommodate them? And it was fair comment, because we only had two, maybe three hotels in Auckland.
Oh, that's right.
Today, I made a phone call to a friend at the airport. 4,000 people arrived at Mangere International before breakfast today. So things have changed a bit.
Well, they certainly
have. And it's because people like the hierarchy of Teal, Jeff Roberts and Frank Reeves and all that lot had the courage to think, we're not a little country. We're a leading outfit. We're going to take on the big boys and we think we'll beat them. Mm. And we have done.
And I mean, even in those days, the restaurants, only a few were licensed.
Two.
I mean, we weren't a wine-growing country.
No. I remember asking a waiter if I could see the wine list, and he asked me if I wanted to be thrown out. He thought I was having all, yeah. So the result was that the men carried Gladstone bags everywhere they went, and ladies normally had handbags large enough to carry a bottle of wine in that you could have for dinner. But it was so different. It was actually rather refreshing and great fun in finding ways around the regulations.
Yes. Well, I remember even earlier, I remember my mother telling me about tea dances. I don't know if they were still going on.
They were, yes.
But they were strictly non-alcoholic.
Almost.
But everybody came with a hip flask of something.
Yes.
And the same with a lot of the balls.
And everything closed at the weekend, so if you hadn't got your groceries on Friday night, and Friday night was late night closing, you can have TV dinners for 2 days.
Yes. Still, they weren't bad days, but the Pavlova paradise wasn't too bad in many ways.
I think it was jolly good because you had family life. People didn't have to work at weekends. We didn't have 24/7 supermarkets and things like that. People went away fishing or in the caravan or in the boat or something like that. Nowadays, we're all struggling to make more money than the next fellow.
No, and there just wasn't the stress and there wasn't the traffic.
There wasn't the traffic, most definitely, no.
Now, Guy, I believe while you were in Samoa, you and some of the other crew observed a solar eclipse. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's right. Because Samoa is so close to the equator, I was flying with a navigator, and he happened to look in the air almanac and said, my goodness, I think there's going to be a solar eclipse tomorrow. And I checked, and he was right. So these things only happened about once every 28 years. So we went out to a certain place, and he already had, you know, the telescope and the frosted glasses and things like that. And we calculated what time it was going to happen. And we asked, it was the Samoan chief who used to cycle across the runway. We asked him if we could use a piece of his land protruding out to sea to observe the sun. To watch the sun disappear, and he just laughed at us, and so did everybody else. But then the sun did begin to disappear, and eventually he got rather nervous and said, because the temperature dropped about 15 degrees. And
I suppose they didn't believe you to begin with.
No, but then the sun did disappear, and finally he came up and sort of tapped me on the shoulder and said, could you bring the sun back, please? And so I tried to explain to him that it wasn't me, it was just a star phenomenon, but he was convinced that I was a magician who'd arranged the whole thing. And on the day I left, he gave me a lovely present, and I had to give him something back. But he wanted the Air Almanac, because he thought if he had that, he could arrange a solar eclipse whenever he wanted.
Yes.
So we left on a rather nice note. Yes. And I believe he's still trying to arrange a solar eclipse.
And you've still got his gift.
Yes, he has. Yeah. He got good value there.
Yeah. You reckon who got the better value?
I think so.
I think you did somehow.
Yeah.
Now, look, I think our listeners will have really enjoyed hearing about your fantastic, marvellous book, Tasman Echo Alpha.
Yeah, it's just designed to be a good read if you've got to take a long...
It is a good read.
Yeah,
I think it really is.
Yeah. And don't take it too seriously.
Oh, all right.
My motto is, don't spoil a good story with facts.
Oh, fair enough. Now, where can people obtain this?
Well, Whitcools and Paper Plus stores have ample copies. So do the Auckland Airport bookshops. Unity Books in Auckland Central. Readaway Books in Howick sold 10 over the weekend. Popper's Bookshop in Remuera are finding it very popular. In Matakana, there's the Village Bookshop. Mount Eden, there's Time Out. Book Lover in Milford. And if none of them have it, Arcadia Books in Newmarket will have it.
Well, listeners, I promise you, Tasman Echo Alpha is a really good read. So, Guy, I'd like to thank you.
And thank you for listening to me.
Oh, look, I could listen a lot longer, and so could our listeners as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Philippa.
And now we're going to play Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines. And after that, Nancy will be reading the future events.
Magnificent men in the flying machines. They go up to the up, they go down to the up. They enchant all the ladies and steal all the scenes. With their up to the up and their down to the up. Up, down, flying around, looping the loop and defying the ground. They're all frightfully keen, those magnificent men in their flying machines. Those magnificent men in the flying machine, they go up to the up, they go down to the up. Those magnificent men, those magnificent men, those magnificent men in the flying machine.
Deco Retro Future Events.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is Nancy with Future Events. On the 19th of March, Highwick House will celebrate Auckland's own Art Deco Day. This is a fabulous day. Relive the 1930s when fashion was hot, jazz was a blast, and everyone swung. Get out your boaters and boas, pack a picnic lunch, and swing to Highwick to celebrate all things Art Deco. Dance to live music at the Cupcake Cafe. Vintage cars are on show, Hendrick's Gin Bar, and marvellous vintage stalls. So get into action, get yourself a costume, and join us for this very special, stylish event. Sorry, parking is restricted to vintage cars. Elderly and disabled asked at the gate, and we can probably help you. It is best to park either in Westfield 227 or Farmers Car Park. So see you March the 19th. It's 1 to 6pm, Highwick House, 40 Gillies Avenue. You enter from Mortimer Pass. $5 per person, children free. Phone 5245729 or go to www.highwick.co.nz for more information. Look forward to seeing you there. Bye for now.
If you've enjoyed our program today, listen every second Wednesday of the month at 2:10 p.m. or download us anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/DecoRetro. If you wish to join the Auckland Art Deco Society, phone Sue 832-9493 or email Sue Olsen, SUEOLSEN, at extra.co.nz. Bye for now.